Ilya Marritz in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC, and here's a weird factoid. In the 19th century, astronomers' assistants were known as computers. Yes, computers. And at a time when there were few opportunities for women scientists, the Harvard College Observatory hired quite a few female computers for this job. Although their work led to groundbreaking discoveries, these women have largely been forgotten until now. Science writer Dava Sobel writes about their remarkable contributions to astronomy in a new book called The Glass Universe: How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. It's published by Viking, and I am pleased to welcome Dava Sobel to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
What is this glass universe in the title of your book?
It refers to a collection of 500,000 photographs on glass plates of the night sky that were taken over a period of 100 years. This was the vision of the director of the observatory to create a unique resource that could be used for answering all the questions people had about the stars. At the beginning of this story, nobody knew what the stars were made of or why they generated heat and light, how far away they were. And by the end of it, that was all pretty much unraveled.
Right, and these glass plates, there's a few pictures in your book, they don't necessarily look like the night sky if you or I were to go to our backyard and
don't.
Just look up. No.
Yeah, most of them are negatives, so even the ones that just show starscapes are black on white, and that's unusual. Also, they're taken through the telescope, so there's a lot of detail that you wouldn't see just looking up. And many of them are taken through prisms, so that the starlight is spread out into the spectrum. And those images were used to understand the composition of the stars.
And so these glass plates, that was the job of the women that you profile in your book, to basically decode them and make sense of what came in on the plates. Is that right?
That's right. And the term computer was a little older, before the introduction of photography, because there was always math to do at the observatory, any observatory. There were computers wherever there were observatories, and most often they were men, but sometimes they were women. And at Harvard, early on, they were the family members of the resident astronomers. So that was how women really got their first entree. And then they did so well in the work that the directors thought it would be great to just hire women from outside because, of course, they were less expensive. And that's the subtle play of the title, that it's a glass universe, but there was something of a glass ceiling, too.
Right. So you write quite a bit about the Harvard Observatory director, Edward Pickering, this man who was willing to sort of
thoroughly good guy,
go beyond having, you know, wives and daughters help out from time to time, but actually hire women. What was he like? What have you been able to learn about his sort of state of mind as he was actually like writing employment contracts?
He was the most forward-thinking, polite person I have ever encountered. And he, although he might be accused of paying them lower wages than men, that was just a reality he couldn't get past. But he was so supportive of the women. He always gave them credit in all the published work for everything they did. He nominated them for prizes. And he was such a supporter of higher education for women. At a time when people thought college was bad for girls, that college could actually negatively affect a woman's ability to bear children, if you can believe that. And he felt the way to disprove that idea was to give a lot of women a chance to do real work in science and show what they could contribute. And so in addition to the women he hired, he put out a call to college graduates who had telescopes to make observations from home and send them to Harvard, and they would be collated and published, and that then these women could help prove the value of their education.
And we're talking sort of mid to late 19th century.
We're talking 1880s, 1890s.
And
when there were a lot of women's colleges opening.
I was going to say, were there a lot of women who had the kind of math education to do this work, and what was their other choice if they happened to have a knack for math and didn't end up at the observatory?
There weren't a lot of other choices, and there weren't a lot of opportunities either. That's why the volunteer aspect was also important.
So let's talk about some of the women who got involved in this. I don't know where you want to begin, but I thought Henrietta Swan Leavitt was pretty interesting.
She's pretty interesting, yeah. Her discovery really, I'm not exaggerating, but it laid the basis for all of modern cosmology, because her discovery provided a way to measure distance across space. When you look up at the sky, you have no idea what's close and what's far. Some things look brighter than others, but maybe they're extremely bright and far away, and the dim things are actually just naturally dim and close. So her discovery helped create a yardstick, which is still in use today. And yet her
name is pretty much, I mean, is it known at least in the astronomical community?
Absolutely. Every astronomer knows her name.
Uh-huh.
And there is a movement afoot now, I'm happy to tell you, to change the name of her discovery, which has an unwieldy title. It's called the period-luminosity relation. But people are starting to call it the Leavitt Law.
The name for Henrietta Swan Leavitt,
and then her name will revive.
And a few of the discoveries that these women made have endured to this day. You write about Annie Jump Cannon. I hope I'm saying that right.
Yes. One of the great names.
I don't know how you get Jump as a middle name, but why not? And she created sort of a stellar classification system.
Yes, that was one of the goals at the beginning, to look at the spectra of the stars, those strips of separated starlight that had passed through a prism, and try to create a taxonomy, some way to get hold of what the stars were. Were there different types? Were they made of different chemicals, or were they at different life stages in their evolution? All of this was unknown. So the trick was to look at these patterns and try to group the stars according to common patterns. And that is not easy to see. So you're looking at a glass plate that could have thousands of tiny little strips of starlight. So you're looking with a magnifying glass, and then you're comparing one to another and assigning a classification category. And she did this for nearly 500,000 stars.
While being deaf, I should add.
She was deaf, but she wore a hearing aid and was a great opera fan.
Okay, well, why not? Why not?
I know that because she saved all the programs from all the operas she attended, and they're all still in the Harvard archives.
Reading your book, you really come away with the impression that, one, the sciences were not well-funded at the time. They were constantly having to raise money.
They were privately funded, yes. And what interested me in this story was how much of the money came from women.
As benefactors as well.
Yes, yes.
And then the other sort of abiding impression is it seems like the women started to get involved right at a time when studying the stars went from sort of a hobby activity to something that was much more academic and professionalized.
Well, the professional astronomers were stuck doing the really boring work of establishing stellar positions. The astronomers who were skilled and wealthy enough, the amateur astronomers, could pursue whatever aspect they liked. And so this whole question of using the spectra really got a push from the amateurs. So Anna Draper, who was the main funder of the project, she and her husband were at the forefront of that work. And just when they were going to devote their lives to it, he fell ill and died. He was only 45. And she very much wanted to continue the work, live out his dream, and she couldn't do it alone. So she gave the money to Pickering at Harvard and said, if you do the work, I'll pay for it. She gave him more than what he had as an annual operating budget. And she kept that up for 3 decades.
It seems like this must have been a tremendous opportunity for any woman with a really active brain and a knack for math. What did you learn about the women's own professional satisfaction from their letters and the documents that you found, given that what they were doing really was so unusual.
Oh, they knew it. They loved their work. They were there 6 days a week, long hours. They socialized together on Saturday night. It was definitely
What did a Saturday night look like for them? Stargazing?
Oh, Mrs. Fleming. Sometimes there was stargazing of a professional sort. If they were working on a project that required them to be at the observatory, they might go back on a Saturday night. But Mrs. Fleming, who was the first woman to hold a title at Harvard, she was the curator of astronomical photographs, she was generally the hostess at her place and would provide food, and they would sing, someone would play the piano, there were games. Jack Straws was a popular game.
That's one I haven't tried.
It's like pickup sticks.
All right. So how did this go down as these women, you know, worked in the world? Did they have angry husbands and fathers?
Oh, they didn't have husbands. No. Working meant you were not married. So at the very beginning, if a woman got married, she left. Later, by the 1930s, it was more permissible to be a married woman and work. But these women were married to the job, and they stayed there 40, 50 years.
Ilya Marritz on WNYC, in for Leonard Lopate. The book is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. And the author is Dava Sobel, also the best-selling author of the book Longitude. When it comes to, like, unearthing the role of women in science, It seems like there's sort of a renewed effort to do that and to try to shed some light on some forgotten chapters. I'm thinking
of this
movie that's in theaters now about the African-American women who
Hidden Figures helped
put John Glenn in space. But
see, they were really computers.
In terms of the work that they were doing.
Yes.
How hard is it to find a story like this? Are these stories documented?
This story is extremely well documented, as is Hidden Figures. I first came on the Harvard Women more than 20 years ago because an astronomer I was interviewing, Wendy Friedman, who was working on a Hubble telescope key project about the expansion rate of the universe, mentioned the name Henrietta Leavitt to me as a crucial figure in the history of this work, and I had never heard of her. And then when I looked into her story, I discovered she was working in a room full of women, which seemed remarkable to me. One doesn't think of Harvard as a hotbed of female opportunity, but there they were. And I was surprised that no one had written it up. There was a biography of Henrietta Leavitt by George Johnson some years ago. It's called Miss Leavitt's Stars. But I wanted to treat the group and the situation, because the situation led to a graduate program in education. When Harvard finally started a graduate level program in astronomy, all the first students were women.
No
kidding. Because of this history.
No kidding.
And because the donors had set up fellowships for women to come and work at the observatory for a year and then be able to go on to another observatory with that training. And because all of the fellowship money was specifically earmarked for women, the only fellowship money available for graduate students.
And that was the group they called Pickering's Harem.
Pickering's Harem was earlier. That was the computer group, the women looking. But they didn't. That term is a more recent term.
Oh, and I see.
Pickering would never have said that.
And did the effects of this group go beyond Harvard? In other words, is astronomy like a more gender-balanced field than some of the other sciences, I'm wondering?
I don't know that I could really speak to that, especially today. Things are changing so quickly. But certainly, the number of women who went through an apprenticeship at Harvard and then went to work somewhere else was significant. And also, because astronomy was always a global endeavor, everybody knew the Harvard women. Everybody knew how productive they were. And they had contacts with other astronomers around the world, correspondence that survives. So it was well known that women could be given these positions of responsibility and handle them admirably.
And so what kind of adversity? I mean, it sounds like a very smooth ride, but they must have encountered some adversity.
Well, mostly they complained about the low pay. But this is nothing new, and it persists, as we know. So, but the work was fascinating to them.
And to you, as a science writer and a woman, why does it matter to you so much to tell a story like this?
I think in this day and age, especially this particular moment in history, when there's a lot of fake news and there is a lot of anti-science bias, anybody who can tell a true story about science, and especially a true story about women in science, can take that opportunity and feel good about it.
Yeah. Did the women often have trouble getting respect from the other male scientists? Maybe not at Harvard, because it sounds like it was an amazing environment, but they were corresponding with Germany and South America, locations all around the world.
No, I didn't see any evidence of that. It was the case of you do something significant and you do it well, you get the respect. They really gained a good place in everyone's estimation.
I understand the original glass plates that these women star scientists worked with.
They're all still at Harvard.
And they're being digitized.
They're being digitized now because they're still of great value.
Really?
Yes. It's important to be able to look back over a period of 100 years and take a new discovery and look at that area of the sky and see what was there 50, 60 years ago. Sometimes that's crucial. People have been coming to the observatory to study the plates. Pickering used to send them out to people to borrow. But once they're digitized, they'll be available to everyone. And of course, they're glass, so they're fragile. We'd rather not have people touching them.
Precious cargo.
Yes.
I've been speaking with Dava Sobel about her book, The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. Unlikely, forgotten chapter of history. Very cool stuff. It was named one of the best books of 2016 by NPR, The Economist, and Smithsonian, and it's published by Viking. Dava, thank you so much.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.